All right, my shit show ladies, let me tell you about how I can make getting dressed so much easier for you. Armoire is a clothing rental membership where you get to build your perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you gotta do is take a 5-minute style quiz and then select from your personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new to you styles. So I love this because I'm on video quite often on interviews and social media content, and I don't want people to be like, is that the only shirt that this girl owns? I also would not consider myself in the know of what's hot and what's not. But with Armoire, I get to pretend like I'm a fashionista. So this is perfect for working moms, for stay-at-home moms, for any women who just don't feel like going to the store. Now, right now, you shit show ladies can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off your first month. So that is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/littlechild. That is armoire.style, armoire.style/littlechild to get 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear ever again.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
A crappy childhood does not have to be a life sentence for a crappy life. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shitshows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shitshow. I am the captain of this hot mess of a ship. And this is where we talk about what to do when your childhood screwed you up a whole lot more than you initially thought that it did. So today, we are diving deep into an oldie but a goodie, because this gal needs to give herself a little bit of a break. And I'm saying this out loud because perhaps this is going to give you permission to give yourself a break as well. Yeah, I was just thinking, I've been doing this. My first episode was March 31st, 2021. I think there's only been like one time where I did not put out an episode at all during the week. I think there's been two times where I've done reruns. So I'm allowed to do another rerun, okay? I'm allowed to do a rerun. I've been in a lot of physical pain. So my neck and my shoulder, it's been giving me issues for a while, but I pinched a nerve or I did something on Saturday and my arm has been numb and my hand has been tingling and I just have not been sleeping great. And yeah, I need to give myself a bit of a break for today. And so thank you, Carrie, for giving me the permission to do a rerun for today. But don't you worry, because I've been working on these conflict and conflict resolution episodes that you'll be getting next week and the week after. And this seems to be a topic that's really resonating with people. As I said last week, that I think there is so much to be gained, so much self-awareness, so much growth that can come from us looking at the ways in which we handle conflict and show up in conflict. So yeah, I'm excited to dive into these episodes with you because I've been putting a lot of thought into it in hopes that you guys can get a lot out of these next two episodes. But for today, you're getting the crappy childhood fairy who needs no introduction. I'm sure you guys are all familiar with her. She's amazing. Anna Runkle. She has an amazing YouTube channel where she focuses on complex PTSD, and she is just a wealth of knowledge. She has a way with words. She's a powerhouse when it comes to this topic. So this is episode 35. 35. This is from November 10th of 2021. So her and I need to have her back on. I've been playing a little email tag with her for like a year to get her back on. So I'll reach back out to her and we'll get that scheduled and have her back on. So let's just get the damn show on the road. But first, let's talk about why you need to damn the Joy and Shit Show. This is my online support community where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups where you get to connect with fellow shit shows like yourself who are doing the damn work to heal and want to have a little fun while doing so. So again, this is less than $1 a day. Okay, let me ask you, is your recovery, is your healing worth less than $1 a day to you? I think that it is. So how about you give it a try? Damn the join. See the link in the show notes. You can quit after a month if you don't like it, but let's just do it. Yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever. Next, give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, whatever you do, give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. While you still can, don't even try to understand. Just find a place and play your hand. Take it easy. Well, it is my pleasure to introduce Anna Runkle. She is the creator of the amazing YouTube channel, Crappy Childhood Fairy. She also has tons of online courses and tons of material to help all us suffering adult children. I've been wanting to talk to you for quite some time. So welcome, Anna.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, I want to tell you that you are the first guest that I've had that is a magical being.
You mean the fairy?
Yeah, you're my first spiritual magical being that we've had on the pod. So how does that make you feel?
What an honor. Isn't that a goofy name? I just love the name though. When I first started this, I had some very serious name like Your Healing Year. And then I just realized like I'm just sick to death of getting all gloomy about this. It's got to be kind of fun and interesting to persist with it. So I ended up with the name Crappy Childhood Fairy, which I feel like is self-explanatory.
That is the underlying theme of this podcast, is learning how to laugh at this shit, at this crap, right? So glad you're doing the same. And I love a curse word in a title anyways. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Love it.
People are bothered. It's kind of funny, but there's a whole subset. Like there's some people in India who are very formal and they write to me and I'm not sure they know what crappy means in our vernacular. I'm not sure because they call me Dear Mrs. Crappy. And I love that.
You should.
I am Mrs. Crappy.
Mrs. Crappy. Yeah. It's okay. I tend to say the F word. I'll just say fuck quite a bit. I've gotten 2 messages from people saying not a fan, but let's just be honest. I've had about 100 messages saying that they love it. So
I'm gonna keep fit right in.
Yeah.
I'm on YouTube. I have to be somewhat careful to be monetized.
But. This is true. Yeah. So what I thought we could do, because there's quite a bit that I want to talk with you about, but I want to start with you. So kind of in, as they say, when people share in 12-step meetings, I want to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So tell me about your childhood.
Tell me about your childhood. Yeah. I grew up in an alcoholic family in Berkeley. I was born in the 60s. My mom got really into the hippie thing and my dad did not.
Had they moved out here for that or were they already living here?
No, they were already living here. Neither of them were born in the Bay Area, but they came here for college.
Okay.
And they were fabulous, intelligent, worldly people. But they had alcoholism real bad, especially my mom. And we had all the problems that tend to go with alcoholism. There was, you know, she was really flaky. She, when I was a month old, she took off for a month with some man, you know, and then she'd come back and they were sort of breaking up, getting together, breaking up, getting together. Lots of drama, violence, later money problems. They started out like, I don't know, I think we were pretty middle class, but we came down, down, down the ladder. And they got divorced when I was 7 and my mom remarried.
Did you have siblings?
Yeah, my mom had 4 kids from 3 different marriages and I was from the second dad. So an alcoholism hit my siblings real hard too. Out of the 4 of us, 2 have serious alcoholism. 1 died from it. Yeah. So I was more of like the good kid, the one who tried to put on a happy face and have it all together. And I also had a couple of advantages of neighbors, you know, kids in the neighborhood whose moms saw what was going on. And I've maintained relationships with some of those families. And what's cool is to hear now what people could see from the outside. And in those days, you know, people would see something was wrong, but you didn't like call the authorities back then.
Yeah.
And maybe that was for the best. I wouldn't have wanted it. I went out of my way as a child to hide how bad things were. I also had these incredible teachers in my elementary school who really validated me, helped me know my worth, promised me that I was intelligent and was going to be okay. And let me bring my sister, who was 3 years younger, like a toddler, to school with me every day. And she had hot lunch with us and just the whole thing. So the informalness of the way society was structured back then really helped me.
So and you were bringing her to school to protect her?
Well, there was nobody to take care of her, you know? So my mom would just take off. So yeah, I didn't know what else to do. Just take her with me. And so things got a little more stable in my family when my mom remarried. She remarried a guy who was not an alcoholic and we moved to Arizona. And that was kind of a different chapter in how the whole thing played out. My older brother ended up an alcoholic and heroin addict. And more in my recovery, I've been really coming to terms with, he was a major source of trauma for me. He used to torture me and threaten me and bully me. And
he's older. You know,
7 years older, much bigger. And definitely like, I was afraid of him all the time. I slept with a knife under my bed, you know, to keep him off. And my parents they just weren't that involved that it didn't occur to me to even go to them about this stuff. So
you think that that's normal or maybe you don't know it's normal, but you don't know any different.
Yeah.
You weren't taught to talk about things.
No. But you know, I was lucky again. We lived in this very cool neighborhood where there were really interesting, good parents in our midst. I was a babysitter. I was always very entrepreneurial. I started babysitting at 9. Wow. And then I started a yard work business and a jewelry business. And I delivered papers and I sold flowers. And we were very, very poor. So if I wanted to have free lunch that wasn't the free lunch, which back then was too stigmatizing for my mind back then. So I would go get junk food with the other kids on money that I earned. And I had to buy my own clothes and things. So I'm sort of like, I'm trying to paint the picture here. Like we had these incredible neighbors. I became entrepreneurial. There were ways that I coped with this that have served me all my life and helped me to be resilient. But I would just say that the childhood trauma, I wasn't totally in touch with it at first, but it really started to show up as a big difference between me and everybody else in my late 20s. Up until that point, like I was creative, you know, I don't know. It just, when I started having relationships and they started not working out, that's where
I can't relate.
Yeah. It's this funny thing. It's just me, right?
Yeah. And,
but it was really taking me down and it was so out of whack. Like other things I was so good at in my life, like having a job or going to college, but having relationships, I was really bad at.
Both. Was it mostly romantic or friendships as well?
Mostly the romantic relationships.
Yes. Broken picker syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's what kind of brought me to recovery in the first place. And
so do you remember as a child, were you aware that alcohol was the problem? When do you remember learning about alcoholism or what is kind of your first memory as it relates to drinking in your family?
That's such a good question. I was 12 when it finally dawned on me. That's what it was. Like I knew there was something wrong. Our house was really messy. We had a lot of broken windows. You know, there were dead cars in the front yard, but I thought it was more like because we were poor And then when I was 12, I remember I was just, it dawned on me. I'm like, this is that thing called alcoholism, isn't it? And there wasn't, you know, there certainly was AA back then, but I remember once I came in contact with some kind of a school counselor. It wasn't a school counselor. I think it was in a drama class or something. And somebody said, you know, there's this thing called Alateen. And I was just like, no fucking way. That just sounds so churchy and bizarre. And I would never do that. So it was there and it was offered to me, but I just didn't, I wasn't ready.
So my experience was, so when I was 7, we were out to dinner. I'm an only child. So I was with my parents. And so we're waiting for my dad to arrive, and my mom had ordered a beer and she was barely drinking it. I could tell that she was upset. And then when my dad came, you know, I saw a tear roll down her face. At some point in the dinner, she took me to the bathroom. And I remember I asked her what was wrong. And she told me that she was an alcoholic. And of course I'm 7 and I don't know what that means. So I say, what does that mean? And she says, that means I can't drink. And it was like, even though I had no idea what that really meant, I 100% knew what it meant. You know, and it was like, from that day on, I knew when my mom was going to drink or when she would drink, even sometimes hours before she would even pick up a drink. You know, I developed that sixth sense. But I just wonder what the difference is in impact as far as, and my dad would talk to me about it. Like I was, you know, I was parentified in that sense. It for you, it sounds like you were very much parentified from like an actual like duty perspective of taking care of your siblings in the house. For me, it was more so emotional. But yeah, I just think about what the difference is in impact when, I mean, for me, obviously I didn't 100% know what was going on, but I was kind of told versus you kind of having to piece together it for yourself, you know?
That's remarkable that she told you. It is like wrong, but still in a way, having that honest information at least was there. I mean, to this day, my family, my mom's been dead for 30 years or something, but still it's very uncomfortable for my family to talk about it. They've always considered me like the weirdo black sheep who does all that California woo-woo stuff, like 12-step, you know, and crappy childhood fairy. We just don't discuss.
Yeah.
That would imply that I was traumatized. Yeah.
And so then did you experiment with drugs and alcohol at all when you were a teenager or you were just?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I did. And it was so normal back then. But it's funny because I thought it was more normal than it was. Yeah. I thought, oh, everybody does it. And so sure, I experimented with everything. And I got lucky that I gave a chance, like drugs and alcohol absolutely could have seized my life. But I suspect it's just genetic. There was something in me that just didn't click with it, didn't get stuck there. And it became unpleasant. And I didn't want to do it anymore.
That's amazing.
But I think what drew me in is I was always drawn to the boys who did it. Mm-hmm. And so I would do drugs and alcohol to be with them. And that's kind of more my gateway drug.
Yeah. So what was your pattern as far as relationships or what was the type that you were attracted to? What was, you know, we typically find ourselves in relationships with the same type of person over and over. So what was your type?
Well, I guess I can say with pride that it hasn't always been exactly the same type. You know, I've had the pleasure of having relationships with some really wonderful men.
Wow.
But sometimes I ended up with serious blind spots around their addictions. So I'll just lay it out there. Twice I have ended up, one time I got together with a guy who was 4 years clean and sober. And this was right after my brother died of heroin and alcohol when I was about 30. And within a week of that happening, I met this guy and I was like 4 years clean and sober. And it was my first year in Al-Anon. I was already in Al-Anon, you know, before my brother died, but I met him and I was like 4 years clean and sober. This is like the most knight in shining armor thing that's ever happened to me. And I felt really optimistic and confident about getting into a relationship with him, but just stuff got shaky for him a couple years in and he ended up relapsing and overdosing. And it was absolutely devastating.
And dying?
He died. Yeah. He died.
God. While you were still together?
Yeah. We were tenuously together because he was using and I was having a hard time handling that. I was doing all those sort of classic Al-Anon moves of like, can't we negotiate this? What if I make rules? You know, I just didn't want to lose him. And when it's happening, it's just so hard to believe like, this is really happening. Is it going to stop? Of course it's going to stop. I know you, you're great. You know, So it, to be honest, it wasn't like this, it wasn't the best relationship ever,
oh,
you know,
really?
But it's the one I was in.
I'm surprised to hear that.
I know.
I was going to ask for his number if he's still alive.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, no, he's, yeah, no. Okay. And so my first marriage was with a guy who was long-term sober and clean, and he is the father of my kids. We're divorced now, and he's still clean and sober, and he's my friend, but we had a rough go of it. And I had a relationship after that with a guy who I had no idea had a drug problem, and he was smoking heroin. And that was, you know, I was already like in my early 40s by then. I was a single mom, and I found out that the guy that I was dating was smoking heroin every day. And that was,
how did you find out?
He told me one day. He told me, he goes, I just have to tell you something. It hadn't been that long. It had been, I don't know who even knows anymore. I've like digested this so much, a few months or something. And in a weird way, we had a great relationship. You know, it was very calm,
right? Fucked up all the time.
He was so tolerant, you know, not stressful, but it was a really hard time in my life. I've had a few times when at this time, you know, with divorce and the little kids, and I had this medical thing going on that was just bad luck, but I was in and out of the hospital, and that's how he was a neighbor. I had like gotten to know him, and because he was helping me deal with my kids and everything. So he was just such a nice guy. But then it turns out he had this terrible problem, and it was a problem that I knew. My brother had already died of it. I had had a boyfriend many years before die of it. I did not want this in my life, but given my upbringing, and heroin was a big thing in my family too. And I just think in the way that alcoholism kind of like gets into your amniotic fluid, you know, it's like the consciousness of heroin, even though it was never my consciousness directly, there was just this weird familiarity or something with it for me. I can't explain it. But something I just went really unconscious around it, and I was clueless, and I didn't know what was going on, and I didn't know what to do. And we fought for a while, and guess what? He died.
While you were together?
Yeah. Tenuously together, because I was like flailing around trying to like set a boundary or say, you have to get treatment, or, you know, and right before he took his own life, and he did it because I broke up with him. So
how many years in between the prior boyfriend overdosing?
Oh, this is so embarrassing. Let's see. 94, 2006, 12 years, something like that.
Okay. Okay. I thought you were going to say 2 years.
Oh, that would be bad, right? No. Yeah. It happened again. Like I had had like successful experiences between, but it happened again. And when it happens again, then you have to, you know, you have to concede to your innermost self something when that happens. And so that's why it was a turning point for me. It was a turning point where I was like, wow, my will, you know, I don't want it anymore. I don't want it anymore. This like grasping at relationships and like trying so hard. And it's hard to be a single mom. And it's hard when you're me not to just be like, oh, gotta, gotta find a man. But I got over it. And I just got this incredible mentor who helped me and got very serious about my spiritual life in a way that I never had. And eventually I met the man I'm now married to. And, you know, basically just cleared it. I just stopped doing that shit. I just stopped, and I set some new criteria for myself. And one of the criteria was I cannot date anyone who doesn't want to get married, who has now or has ever had a drug or alcohol problem. I mean, I have many sober alkies in my circle of friends, but I can't date them. And I knew that. So I have an incredible husband now.
How long have you been married?
We've been married for almost 8 years.
Wow. Well, here's the deal though. You're talking about, you know, setting criteria. I mean, I set criteria all day long. That didn't mean that I followed it. I think what really changed was that you did the inner work, and what you were attracted to and who was attracted to you changed.
Yeah. You know, it's, well, usually I can't have a conversation this specific and deep about this, but you know how it is. No matter I'm sure you worked for years. You know, sometimes you do the work and you still can't change. Like it's easier said than done. Mm-hmm. And I just think sometimes the grace of your higher power comes in. For me, there's been a few chapters, and often it's in those most painful incidents, you know, that in phases kept bringing me to my knees, going, all right, I got to cut this out. Yeah. And I really got to the point, you know, when that second guy died, I really got to the point where I did not want my will. I wanted God's will, even if it was to be alone. And that used to be unthinkable to me. Growing up so neglected, like it was unthinkable to make a decision that I was going to let go of that, and to let go of that, just that driving drive, you know, of like, I must have this. I'm not going to be okay without this. I'm not going to be okay. And that's not totally sick. It's like many of us are called to be married and, yeah. and have children. And that is what I always wanted, but I couldn't put it together.
I know. So what about the blame and the guilt? I mean, did you grieving that? I mean, was there a period where you blamed yourself for both of their deaths?
No, I didn't blame myself at all. It definitely wasn't my fault. And that's one of the nice things.
That's amazing.
About having already been in Al-Anon for these things. Yeah. I knew like I really did everything I could in those relationships. And it's easy enough to think to yourself, well, I wish I hadn't gotten so like freaked out about it. But mm-hmm. you know, if you've ever watched somebody self-destruct, like there's nothing you can do. It's very difficult, but honestly, in both cases, when it got to the point where they died, I was devastated, but there was a certain like sigh of relief that I no longer had to try to figure out what to do. You know, it's a terrible situation. And I just knew I never wanted to be in that situation again. People really judge you though. In both cases, like people in their lives blamed me. Mm-hmm. And so it always involved, I talk about it. I've done it. I've been through this twice, but in both cases, it meant completely moving on from the circle of people I had hung out with. You know, there's just like no carryover whatsoever. And that's part of what's hard about it, but it's just as well, because, you know, if there's some part of you that has created and accepted that kind of a relationship, it's kind of like drinking or drugs. Like, if you really make a decision to turn your will and your life over, you're going to leave it behind. You're going to be willing to leave it all behind. And that's all fine. It's all okay. And something good can come into your life.
Mm-hmm. So I think our experiences are similar in the sense that, so for me, I hit like my adult child bottom when I had 9 years sober. And so basically what my experience was like, I kept, you know, finding myself in these toxic romantic relationships. Not only were the guys not improving, but my state of being, my reactions, the way I handled it when they would end, continued to just get worse and worse and worse. And I couldn't figure out what the fuck was going on with me. Yeah. And having the realization that I was having a trauma response was the most significant and mind-blowing aha moment that I had ever had. And so I was hoping that you could share about your aha moment when you came to terms with the fact that you were suffering from complex PTSD.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? So Katherine Heigl, you know her from Grey's Anatomy, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says that she's seen more issues with dog joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to improve any dog's health: their food. So what she's discovered is that the way many dog foods are made can actually create toxins that could be wrecking our dog's health. But fortunately, she has found that by just adding a few special superfoods to her dog's food, she saw huge transformation in their health. And she has made a 20-minute video explaining step-by-step how anyone can do this same thing to see incredible changes in their dog's health. Now, y'all know I'm a cat lady. Y'all know that Kiki is the queen of the shit show here. But I watched this video and there's actually some things that I can apply to her health. So hopefully she'll live another 15 years or so. So go to badlandsfood.com/adultchild and watch Catherine's video. Again, that is badlandsfood.com/adultchild. Okay, shit show dudes, you can tune out. This is for my fellow shit show ladies. Are you going through perimenopause or menopause? I'm not quite there yet, but I know that I have plenty to look forward to. Feeling like a wet sock driving down the highway, night sweats, poor sleep, feeling tired all the time, bloating, gas, man, can't wait for this shit. Now, if that is applicable to you, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 fucking seconds, okay? Now, Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work. Now, for my younger shit show women like myself, if you struggle from that vicious week before your period, you want to crawl out of your skin, experience cravings, want to eat everything in the damn house, you feel a little bit down or off. Well, Happy Mammoth also has a product for you to make it easier to manage your PMS with their Estro Control. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code adultchild at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code adultchild for 15% off today. Do you know how many times I've set the intention that on Sunday, I'm going to get up, I'm going to plan my meals out for the week, I'm going to go to the store, I'm going to get everything that I need, I'm going to come home, I'm going to make all my meals for the week. Do you know how many times I've actually been successful in doing that? Not once, folks, okay? Not one single time. But alas, I have found the perfect solution. Meet Sunbasket, a team of dietitians and chefs that design wholesome, nutritious, and delicious meal kits delivered to your damn door. You get to pick and choose what you're in the mood for every week. Maybe one week you're feeling Mediterranean, maybe another week you're feeling a little carb consciousness. I like the sound of that. I most recently made, it was a spinach and strawberry salad with steak. It was damn good. So go to sunbasket.com/adultchild today to save $120 across your first 4 deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/adultchild to save $120 across your first 4 deliveries, plus free shipping on your first order.
Yeah. So I got shown the 12 steps by this incredible woman who was sober in AA. I'm not an alcoholic. She is. She showed me back in the day. And when she showed me how to like write my fears and resentments twice a day and meditate. And at the time I used to be too, like, I don't know, proud or something to be shown anything really. I would go to therapy, but I'd control the process or I don't know, but I was so desperate one night and she showed me how to do this. And she had such a beautiful light and joy about her. I just wanted what she had. And she showed me, and it was just this weird part of my story. So then I had to go on and find a 12-step fellowship where I belonged, because I'm not an alcoholic, and I got to go to a lot of open meetings. But the thing was, you know, she'd always go, well, you're not an alcoholic, you're an Al-Anon. And I go, but it's weird, because I go to Al-Anon, and as wonderful as it is, I'm a bull in a china shop there. Mm-hmm. I don't fit in. I'm too much for people there. You know, occasionally somebody relates, but there was a way that I was like profoundly recovering and expanding as a human, but couldn't really connect with people there. And they're just, was no such thing as complex PTSD back then. They didn't know it was a thing. In fact, the whole reason I got into recovery, I had this very bad cluster of things that happened back in 94. That's how I ended up in, is feeling so bad I needed to work the steps. But my mom died. I got assaulted on the street. Mm-hmm. A guy dumped me. I got so fucked up about the whole thing that my PTSD reactivated. So I kind of functioned okay up until that point, but it just like the cat got out of the bag and I could not put it back in. I couldn't read. I couldn't use a phone. I was just freaked out all the time. And I was worried I wasn't going to make it. And I was afraid to tell anybody. Like, I didn't feel like anybody could understand. And so this woman, this alcoholic woman, she understood. She's like, come in, have a cup of tea, get out some paper and pen. I can help you with this. Well, so I got profoundly better. I had a massive spiritual awakening when that happened. I lost the desire to die. I got excited about life. I still had a lot of things that I hadn't worked out yet. Yep. You know, I had, it took more experience and more time in the steps and carrying on with that. And I sponsored hundreds of women and helped, but I mean, hopefully we're all like ongoing, we're all continuing to heal and recover. Right. So I don't even know what lies ahead of me, but I got through one big crucial hump, you know, of healing. Then I hit the problems again. And then tragedy would strike. And then I'd go through a big clump of healing. I just had so far to go, but nobody knew what CPTSD was. So a couple things happened. When this guy killed himself, he made it so I found him. I don't really want to go into it. It's too triggering and yucky for anybody to listen to, but I did CPR. I tried to save him. I had PTSD so bad after that. And I was going to a therapist and I was going to the doctor and I wasn't getting better. It was like a year and a half. And I was still like reliving the whole thing again and again. And it's just weird to me. It wasn't that long ago, but they did not know what to do except keep asking me to talk about it. So one of the key milestones in my healing was to realize that when I talk about my trauma, I basically just get so dysregulated, I can't think. And I've never, ever made progress by talking about stuff. I think it's important to tell your story. But the thing that really helped me was that my friend showed me how to write my fears and resentments and read them to her. And then I could communicate what it was and get her experience, strength, and hope about it, right? But talking about it in a therapist's office, I was beginning to feel like I was this terrible freak. It just wasn't going anywhere. And the doctor and the therapist were like, well, how many times are you having these flashbacks where you keep reliving what happened? I'm like, oh, not that much, you know, like 20 times a day or something. And they were like, ah, we have to put you on serious drugs because this is so bad for you. Mm-hmm. And I had this thought, like, I'll get online. By then we had the internet, you know, this is like 2006 or something. And by then I did some research, like, what do you do when you have this? I began to suspect this is PTSD. And I learned, like, get some hard exercise, you know, drink water, don't eat sugar, don't have wine, don't, you know, just. So I started doing these things and I got like a lot better, not all the way better. Then a really cool thing happened. My meditation teacher, who's a friend of mine, and I had a birthday party for him, and one of his friends was there and we were chatting. By then it's 2008 and like nobody has any money, including me. Mm-hmm. I'm like this single mom with no work. And I ended up talking to him about trauma. He's a therapist who treats veterans, homeless people, and addicts in the streets of San Francisco. And that's like my kind of person. I felt very safe with him. And I told him what had been going on in my life. And he said, you know, I do EMDR. I'd heard of this. And he offered to do EMDR for me for 5 sessions for free, which is just incredible. And sometimes I tell people this and I just want to say, no, he was very safe. It was in no way, it was a simple and pure gift. And it was one of the best gifts anybody ever gave me. And I went in and dealt with my adult traumas, 5 of them. And one of them was like finding that guy. That was the one that was really hard at the time. That memory, that whole re-triggering event turned into a memory in one session. One session. I just couldn't even believe it. And so then I did some other things, you know, some medical trauma and some other things that had happened, getting attacked on the street. And just like boom, 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 5 adult traumas gone. So then I said, okay, I have some money again. I'd like to do some more and try childhood stuff. I didn't have any luck with childhood stuff for EMDR.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I think that's supported by data. It's most effective for adult traumas. So then I started to know what this was. And I learned a little bit from him and from some various sources. Now ACEs science was coming out, adverse childhood experiences. And in my work, I ended up working on a project where I was very quietly learning about that, not like, you know, coming out about it. And then it became necessary as I was dating and then engaged, you know, with my husband. We were together for 5 years before we got married. But right before we were to get married, I had a huge CPTSD like outburst, you know, where I just kind of like flipped out and said really hurtful things. And he said, you know what? I need you to figure this out before we get married. And truer words were never said. It caused me to go look online and find out what can I do. And I found the books, The Body Keeps the Score and Pete Walker's CPTSD from Surviving to Thriving. And I read those and I was like, oh my God, there's a name for what I have. And I fit it exactly. Like, you know, when you have it and you read what it is, you're just like, that's what I have. And it was this beautiful, liberating thing to find out, like, it's a thing. It's not just me. It's not just, I can't tell you how many times people were like, I'd be like, I don't know. I've been choosing self-destructive relationships. And they'd go, well, you must just be trying to recreate your childhood. And I'd think, I don't think so. You know, I think that I am trying to have something better than that. I don't know why I do this. And so reading those books and actually, you know, the consciousness, it's not, those books are not everything. And now I make a lot of stuff about what it's like. But I think a lot of stuff has been psychologized by normies, you know, sure, it looks like that. Or when women put on 200 pounds who have been sexually abused and they say, oh, they're just trying to avoid sex. Well, maybe some of them, but you know, there's also a lot of endocrine disruption with trauma and sexual abuse. It messes up the relationship of insulin and leptin. And so that will do it too. And so there's just a lot of stuff that is so liberating where you go, oh, they were wrong. They psychologized all of this. In some cases, it might be surely a neurological phenomenon. And that's, so I zeroed in on part of complex PTSD that really spoke to me, and it's dysregulation. And it's a measurable thing that goes on in your brain and nervous system. And for people who were abused or neglected as kids, you can see this. They have an intense reaction to stressful thoughts as adults. that causes reasoning in the left front cortex to quiet down and emotions in the right front cortex to get bigger. So reasoning is down, emotions are up, and that pretty much describes what happens under stress when you have CPTSD. But then it leaves you discombobulated and hard to focus. And, you know, we got called ADHD or borderline. You know, there's all these like diagnoses that people get that are sometimes possibly just complex PTSD. I don't know. I never get into diagnosis. I don't worry about it. I focus on symptoms. And if I'm dysregulated, there's not a lot I can do to solve my problems. So I realized that the writing and meditation that I had learned from my friend that hard night in 1994 was a re-regulating tool. And that when I used it, I got better. But the second part of my trauma was that I had learned some very dysregulated habits about like having relationships. So here's the thing about getting into sick relationships where you don't see it coming. If a situation is stressful, which meeting a guy that you like is, your reasoning goes down, your emotions go up. And so you'll find yourself again and again, marching off a cliff into
ignoring red flags. It's, we go colorblind.
but it's your brain. It's not because you're willfully stupid or anything like that. Your brain literally will shut down your reasoning at these moments. And if you end up sleeping with somebody during such an unconscious, semi-conscious, it's not like you're not out, you appear conscious, but your whole brain is not working for you. Then you're bonded. And if you have a bunch of abandonment trauma, then you're stuck. Now you have to stay with them until they,
die. Been there. Or until they like dump you after 3 weeks and then you act like you're, that the world's over. Yeah, I've been there.
That's abandonment melange. That's a thing,
I know.
I love that. There's a word for that too. And I'm like, I have that.
Yeah.
Your world is over. Yeah. I don't know. For me, having a name for these things and knowing they're a thing and they're normal for people who went through abnormal upbringings, it was like half the pressure off.
100%. It released so much shame from me.
Yeah.
You know, I think that some people would maybe even feel like, oh, like learning that you have this is shameful. And it's like, no, because for years, I just thought I was like inherently flawed and unfixable. And having this realization and knowing what the deal was, that's when like change, recovery, healing became a possibility for me.
Yes, that's right. And everything that goes on, there's so many ways that people approach healing from trauma, but basically none of them were useful to me until I could learn to re-regulate and start to keep that as like foundational to anything I was trying to do. So I no longer try to go in and talk about stuff just like that. Just like, okay, I'm going to, we're going to get to the bottom of this by talking about it. Like I no longer expect that. And I'm really tuned into the way I start dysregulating sometimes in certain situations. My nose goes numb. I begin to notice that, or my hands start getting clumsy. And then that's a sign for me. I'm like, oh, I'm dysregulating. And if I'm trying to have an important conversation or make a big decision about something and my nose is going numb, I just know like, stop, I need to hold on. I need to re-regulate, even if it takes a day or an hour or 5 minutes. And it saves a world of trouble in terms of like conflict with my husband. Like if I'm starting to feel signs of dysregulation, I have to treat that. It's like trying to talk to somebody drunk, like don't do it, don't do it. If you're dysregulated, then, with reasoning off, then you become unreasonable. And then that hurts the relationship. So it becomes possible to, suddenly there is a level playing field that's possible to enter and begin practicing on. And it takes practice, but you can go there now because you can regulate emotions and nervous system.
High level, do you want to talk about this, the writing exercise that you do? Or do you want me to just direct people to your page? Or
I'll give you a link. I have a free course and called The Daily Practice. And it's the very techniques that I was shown by this woman that I've been using. But I've really crafted this course to suit people with complex PTSD. And it's a very specific writing technique. A lot of people will go, I've been doing your journaling technique, and I always get feisty and I go, it's not a journal. A journal is where we commemorate and remember and analyze things that happened so that we can read it again someday. This is where we take out the trash of our minds. So it's all the disturbing thoughts. We just lump it into two simple categories. It's fear or it's resentment. And we get it on paper. And then I would just, I write a little prayer asking for it to be removed at the end. And for people who prefer to work with just their higher self, they don't want to use a higher power, then, you know, I've suggested a format. And so I have a little PDF. It's like, you could say this, I hereby release. But the goal is to not have this stuff. What I love about having a higher power and really authentically having that experience and that power in my life is I can trust that if I let go all my concerns, and then I sit down in meditation for 20 minutes and just kick back and rest my mind. I don't have to breathe a certain way or sit a certain way. Feels really just restful. Or I'm very fidgety. I'm a fidgety meditator, but it doesn't matter. What happens is my mind is refreshed. And sometimes that's just like a nap or feels like a nap. And sometimes I get a lot clearer about something that seemed overwhelmingly hard or confusing. Mm-hmm. And some problems, they just like, I forget what I was even worried about, you know, does so-and-so not like me? I forget, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And that's like, that's really nice. Or sometimes I get clearer, like, you know what? I've really got to do something about some problem that's happening. You know, my kid's struggling in math or something. And I'm going to have to step up for that. I think I've not done enough about that. So it sort of gets put into order and then given back to me when I come out of meditation. And I'm telling you, I started doing it just to save my own life, just to get through terrible nights. And it helped me with that. But over time, it also became how I developed my intuition and my intelligence and my clarity. And doing what I do now, you know, I've started a few businesses since I've been doing all of this. But now the business of Crappy Childhood Fairy has completely become my career. And what's kind of cool about it is that it's a business that's run off of my conscious contact. You know, every day I'm just kind of like, what shall I do? And I, you know, many of us have discovered that the meaning, like real happiness and meaning, comes from living our lives in a way that benefits all. That's mm-hmm. like, that's a very happy thing. And I have the pleasure of doing that now as best I can. But, you know, more than anything I've ever done, I get to have that contact with people who are working on healing. And one thing I hear over and over again in comments and in letters I get is I've never heard my condition described by anybody ever before. Like, I describe my experience and other people relate.
Yep. Yep.
And so every time somebody says that, like, I get that relatedness too, where I was just the weirdo and the bull in the china shop everywhere I went. And there's something about like serving others that like accelerates your growth. It's so wonderful.
So I want to talk about one of my favorite videos of yours. And I think that this is very relevant to all of my listeners. And that is the three behaviors that push people away with complex PTSD. And so the first one is this, you talk about like how our loneliness gets leaky. And this is something that I've actually been talking about a little bit. So, you know, my issue in the past in dating is I'm a bit of an oversharer. You know, and I couldn't understand why this was freaking people out, but yeah. Can you talk some about when our loneliness gets leaky?
Leaky loneliness. Yeah.
Sounds so sexy, huh?
I know.
Got it.
Well, yeah, one of the core signs of complex PTSD is loneliness, and mm-hmm. it's a lonely condition. It's a disease of loneliness. And so is alcoholism for that matter. And loneliness is just part of it. And that's what it does. It alienates us and makes us feel different. And in some ways we are different, but there's a lot of behavior that goes with it. And I think it comes back to, we get very triggered by people. I can speak for all of us that people are triggering. And one of the ways that we can deal with that is to hold ourselves separate from them, to avoid them, to be either overtly separate or secretly separate, where you pretend you're at the party, but you're not really sharing yourself with anybody. Or I have a video called Covert Avoidance that was very popular. A lot of people understood. And a friend of mine had described something that totally encapsulated it. She go, I would go to parties, but pretend that I was the photographer. She'd come with a camera around her neck. And that way she could sort of talk to people and then go, okay, got to go take some pictures. But she wasn't really the photographer, or she'd walk around with a clipboard, you know? I was like, I so get that. Like, I need something in front of me with other people. It's just too much. And it's really triggering. So now, because I write and meditate all the time, if I get stressed out at a party, I'm off in the bathroom. I've got paper and pen with me always. You know, I fear nobody here likes me, fear I don't fit in, fear they're all rich people, and fear they're normal, and you know, whatever's got me weirded out, fear I'm going to end up eating all the cookies. That's not appropriate. whatever it is. But
it could be a lot. It could be worse.
Yeah. Yeah. But so that loneliness, it's like, it's alienating having this thing. But part of it is real. And part of it is like in our minds that people are just too much and we can't deal with them. And there's a lot of healing that happens that makes it possible to be closer to people. But I don't know, you know, I think that's probably one of the lingering things for me and a lot of people is I sort of put on a fake face sometimes for social situations. I have
the opposite. I'm like,
you just
I'm
tell just, them everything.
Yes. I'm too much of my authentic self.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that recovery means like really being who you are. Recovery means having a little bit of steering wheel on that, you know, a little bit of gas pedal to know how fast or slow, but to really like, well, the woman who showed me how to recover so long ago, once I was telling her, I go, you know, fear I was inappropriate. She said, we don't work these steps to be appropriate. We work these steps to be ourselves. And she was always like a super advocate of like becoming yourself. And that I, in turn, am an advocate that we heal from CPTSD, not just to not be depressed or to be able to keep a job or a relationship.
Oh, but to live as our authentic selves.
To become our real selves. And yep. If yourself has a lot of like feelings and stories and you know, what could be better than for you to be a podcaster? Mm-hmm. There's a place for that. There's a, you know, there's a place for you in this world.
Yeah. Just not on a first date. I'll just do it. I just need to do it. Not on a first date.
Can I tell you about my sexual abuse?
Yeah, exactly.
Very, you know, yeah. I'm feeling it right now. It's kind of weird.
Yeah. I've just spent 3 years, you know, healing. This is my first date back. I tend to pick emotionally unavailable alcoholics and want to kill myself after 3 weeks. So hopefully I'm not going to do that this time, dude.
I know.
Are you interested? Don't you want to have sex with me now?
I know. Yeah. Yeah.
I know
yeah,
my mom was an alcoholic when I was 7. How about you?
Yep.
Yeah. No, it was interesting. There was somebody that I had on the podcast. She had posted something the other day about how oversharing just comes from this deep need to feel connection, especially when for most of our lives, we felt so dismissed or invalidated.
Yeah. Yeah. I do understand as few others can. Mm-hmm. But yeah, what can you be but yourself? And I think that as we heal, we become less identified with this, with what happened in the past. And we mm-hmm. start to have a new story and there's a little bit more to say about that. And so that buffers people. And so we have a little bit more of latitude to be selective about which part of ourselves we're going to share. But I still feel like, well, I don't know. I'm just so glad to have a CPTSD community. I'm doing this. I'm following this food program called Brightline Eating that is really brilliant. And by this created by this woman who was originally a 12-step person, Susan Pierce Thompson. And I've created a little group within my crappy childhood fairy community of people who are following this food plan. It's like no flour, no sugar, you know, bounded quantities, meal times, no snacks, very sensible, very flexible.
I'm all about carbs, baby. Gotta have carbs.
Yeah. 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 So we're doing this together and I just love this group so much and normally like groups are always a little touchy with me, but if everybody has CPTSD and everybody's a little wonky around carbs, I fit right in. I'm like, okay, I'm safe. And the way that they get kind of like weird or have bad days, it's like, I understand. I'm not alienated by it. I'm not judging it. And that's not always true. You know, the way some people get bothered by things that I don't understand, I feel kind of lost with them. So,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there are people for me.
Well, I know. I was just talking about that with my therapist yesterday about how she was saying, what did she ask me? She basically something like, do you envision yourself like having friendships with people who aren't in recovery? And I said, well, I think in order for me to have a deep and meaningful relationship, I want them to be on some path of self-improvement and especially on some path of self-awareness.
I think I prefer people who have suffered before.
Yes, you know, exactly.
Who know something about joy too. That would be my favorite kind of person. And I'm less particular about how they did it.
Yes. Okay. So then some of the second behavior in that video is you were talking about being other focused. So could you talk about that?
Well, you know, sometimes we call that codependence, but that's a tricky word. Everybody means something different by it, but other focused, just like, I don't know, what do you want to do? And let's see if he calls again. And the other focus thing, Like, it's just not attractive. And I think that I had a strategy for a long time. I would not consider myself strictly codependent. I have tendencies at times, you know, sometimes my behavior is more on the yang of that, but the becoming other focused and having my happiness dictated by whether or not somebody is happy or in my life or any of that stuff is so disempowering. Mm-hmm. And the absolute best moments in my personal growth have been where, well, like when I discovered I had a higher power, I went from like thinking that was bullshit to having a profound experience. And that freed me up a lot from feeling like any one person or thing had to work out. I just started to have a confidence, like, I don't know, whatever happens though, I'll figure it out. Me and my higher power will figure it out. And I began to have a sense of sort of, this sounds a bit grand, but personal destiny, like, well, I've been kept alive this long, so I know that I'm for something. And so whatever it appears is happening right now, it's going to somehow, you know, work out, and it might even be used for the good. And lately I've had the pleasure of finding out that a lot of my hard experiences and shitty jobs or whatever I've had to do in my life, like, it's all being used right now to be good at what I do now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all served a purpose.
Yeah. And so other focused, it's a funny thing though, when you're, so, who was it? Somebody, maybe Richard Grannon, a YouTuber. I may have that wrong. So if somebody hears this and can correct it in comments or something, you know, but codependence is it's like a pathological need to manipulate people's feelings about things. And I was like, yeah, you know, I like, it's Christmas and I want it to feel Christmassy, and I'm going to get all stressed out, you know, trying to make sure it feels like the Christmas that I wanted it to feel like for everybody. So that's actually very self-centered. Like, you think you're doing it for other people, but it's actually like a big self-centered drive. And that's very counterintuitive at first, but being other focused is really being self-centered, of trying to like fix yourself using other people and make them feel another way. And I was, you know, I have an ex-friend. I have a friend who I loved very much, but who was really codependent, who once said to me, as things were sort of falling apart in her goodwill towards our relationship, she said, "I'm just really disappointed. You are not who I thought you were." And yeah, I know. And it hurt really bad at the time, you know, and I thought, how did I fail? But there was some wisdom ended up dropping into my mind about that. That was like, I'm sorry that your fantasy of me has been so disappointing as you saw who was actually standing in front of you.
Bang.
Yeah.
Mic
yeah.
drop.
Yeah. Well, I never said that. I try to, you know, nowadays when I exit friendships or anything, I try to be as
graceful
minimal.
As possible. Yeah.
Yeah. Graceful and kind. Like, why even leave anybody with any criticism? Just if all you need is to end it, just end it. But so I was as nice as I could be, but that's something I ended up reflecting on a lot, that fantasy of who people should be. And isn't that what shitty relationships are all about, where you end up rushing in with somebody, you know, getting all bonded with them, and then frantically trying to retrofit them into this like fantasy version of them that you had at the beginning, as if that would fix you. And nobody likes it. I don't like it when people do it to me, and I'm miserable when I do it to other people. So it just seems to me that, you know, to really be awake means to kind of see things as they are, and to have like an inner, I'm preaching to the choir, I know, but when you have an inner source of like, I just know where my joy comes from. I know where my comfort comes from. I know people are going to come and go, but I know where to go for my sustenance. Then you're a little freer to just like let people be themselves. It's not so dire. They conform to your expectation.
Perfect little plans and designs.
Yeah.
And then the third behavior was, you say lack of clarity about yourself, but I guess it's more so kind of seeing our part in things. Taking responsibility.
Oh, yeah. I think that's pretty advanced stuff. It was for me. I like to think that I'm all fixed now, but probably I, you know, like everybody, I'm going to keep learning about this. But just to kind of see, well, here was a turning point for me. So after my first marriage, for about 2 years, I was really angry at my ex, and we were fighting a lot. I had this wonderful day where I got over the anger. But part of what helped me get there is I had a friend who said, "I'm really sick of you complaining about him. You know, you married him." And it got through to me. I'm like, oh, I married him. And I see this all the time. I think I think there's a lot of emphasis in sort of like PTSD and trauma healing, certain YouTube channels and things. There's a lot of emphasis on what's wrong with other people. And this idea like, well, they're narcissists. And, and the phrase, I attract narcissists. Like I've always had the sense to go, well, that's not really the issue. It's that you bond, you sleep with them and now they're your boyfriend. That's more the problem, you know, than who they're attracted to. It's your attraction to them. And so it's really, like really seeing our part. So I married a guy who was there in a very complicated situation. And it was miserable in ways that were very predictable to everybody around me. And then I blamed him for it. And like everybody does that, right? Everybody does that, but you can't really heal till you just realize like something in me chose that. And then I couldn't really face that. It's too terrible to face until there was this thing, a name for what I have, which is CPTSD. And I like, that is so normal for a woman who as a girl was abandoned and neglected. That's just really normal. I'm normal. And it plays out that way. So you can do workarounds. Isn't that cool? You know? And that, I think I was always waiting, like if I would just have a realization about things and realizing the truth is part of it. But sometimes you have to just take action on a lot of workarounds, like no dating without consulting with my mentor about dating, you know?
Yep. Well, this has been so wonderful. What are you working on anything right now? Anything you want to promote?
I'm writing a book.
Amazing.
I'm writing a book right now. Yeah. And
what's it called? Crappy Childhood Fairy?
Yeah. The Crappy Childhood Fairy Manifesto. If the publisher will agree to that, it's the Crappy Childhood Fairy Manifesto. And I'm, you know, describing my experience dotted in to the approach that I'm teaching, which is a little bit radical in light of how most people do this, you know, with ideas like talking about it can keep you trapped. You got to give some time to not talking about it. And focusing on what happened to you can keep you trapped. And you know, you need tools to begin to focus on becoming aware, like, what am I doing? How did I get into this problem again? And then I teach really practical stuff. I teach the daily practice for re-regulation. And I've sort of evolved into this Dear Abby advice person. You know, people, I get like hundreds of letters every week from people. And it's my joy to, I get to cherry pick them on things where I think I have some helpful answers, but I run those a lot on my YouTube channel as my answers to these letters. I'm doing a letter today. I just recorded a letter today from a woman who she was trying to set boundaries and doesn't want to be used in casual sex, but her understanding of boundaries is very informed by her childhood. So she would say, I want this, but she doesn't act on it by getting out of the situation that is not that. And I'm like, oh, I understand that. I can help with that. So my book is a lot of, you know, I've ended up with a pretty coherent philosophy and it's going to be laid out in the book. And I'm really excited because then it's putting out into the world. This is my point of view. And then next year, I'm really hoping things will lighten up around COVID and I'll be out doing live events. I can't
wait. Amazing. Well, yeah. I definitely want to have you back. This has been great. And I feel like we have plenty to talk about. So this was just scratching the surface. So
I like instantly talk like old friends, don't we?
Yes. Which is what I like. You know, typically I typically like to talk to people before I interview. This is so just everyone knows this is our first time connecting. Cause I usually want to make sure that I have that authentic, you know, cause this podcast is all about, I want it to sound authentic and, you know, and some people are a little stiff, so I'm glad that this worked out.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Yeah, I'll put all of your stuff in the show notes. So thanks so much.